So, well, anyway, you—that's what the mystery writer does. She or he throws you all of these tricks.
As long as they're legitimate. As long as they're legitimate clues or non-clues, you know, that they come out of the character of the person.
Well, it's interesting you said that. It seems to me, I haven't read Agatha Christie for many years, but it seemed to me in reading some early Agatha Christie novels that she didn't play fair. You know, I can't remember now, it's been so many years, but she would, the solution wouldn't really be accurate. You could never really figure it out because she would have a trump card someplace that she would throw in. And you know what I'm talking
about? Yeah, oh sure, I know exactly what you mean. And yet she did the perfect one, The Murder of Roger Ackroyd, which is considered absolutely one of the most brilliant, to be in the murderer's mind. And he did slip in something that you should have been able to pick up along the way. And that's, but I feel it, well, I write suspense. So even if you guess who did it, it's really, will he get her? You see? It's sort of a two-level thing. It is not just if you can spot him early or if you spot him on the page when she spots him. It's not as important as, for me, it's not as important as, even if you're aware it's he, you want to say, don't go there. Be careful.
Well, tell me how Well My Pretty One Sleeps came about, because you have an awful lot in here about fashion and designing.
Well, I come by that naturally because my mother was the bridal buyer of B. Altman and Company. She never called it Altman's. You know, the old girls did not. She retired in 1925 at age 40 because in those days you didn't work. You know, it was an insult to your husband to work. And proceeded to produce three of us. But even when we had no money after my father died, I was always well-dressed because she'd walk down Fifth Avenue and she'd go to the sale rack and get a dress that had been $40 and it was $5 now because she just knew clothes. And I grew up knowing clothes, knowing, oh, Mary, that's too cheap. No, dear, you can't have that. That's badly cut. The hem is poor. The lining is bad. That kind of thing. And when I was, from the time I was 15 years old on, I was working in Saturdays in Bonwits and Lord & Taylor to and Bloomingdale's just so I could buy clothes. I used to get $5 a day for that effort, but I was able to buy the clothes. And then I did a radio show where I interviewed designers. So it really came kind of something that was always developing in me.
Are you the type who could have gone to S. Klein and found something good?
Oh, Madame Klein's on the square? Oh, sure. One of the prettiest dresses I ever owned, I paid $5 for there when I was about 23. It was beautiful. But I'm to have better luck going into the other stores and where you don't have to go through a lot of junk and just getting to the sale rack. I did that for years. But when I was 15 or 16, I'd walk down Fifth Avenue and mentally shop. You know, I'd shop in all the windows and say, no, I don't like that, and I'll take this, and I'll wear those shoes with it. And I had a wonderful time because I said, someday when I'm a writer, I'll be able to buy all those things.
Men are different. I am so indifferent about clothes, and I try to force myself to buy a new suit every year so that I have something current. But the fact of the matter is, often 2 years will go by, I'm wearing the same old suit, and I know I shouldn't do that, but it just seems to be, men are kind of like that, aren't they? I mean, the suits are like uniforms anyway.
Well, you see, in this book, she always lays out her father's ties, as her mother had before her. Yeah. And she does admire the way the publisher dresses, because he's one of those who has a good instinct for clothes, and he dresses well, and I guess she tells him that. But I know I always laid out my husband's ties. He hadn't the faintest idea which tie went with a suit, you know. In fact, when we were engaged, he wore the same tie with everything, and I couldn't wait. I was just too shy to say, get rid of that tie. The minute we got married, I said, there's just one thing I want to do. And he said, what? I said, cut up that tie.
Well, I'm like your husband. I always wear a beige tie. I mean, I've worn this beige tie now for 8 years, and it goes with everything.
That's almost like being a mother-in-law at a wedding or the groom's mother. Wear beige and keep your mouth shut.
Yeah, so when in doubt, you wear beige. Well, you said something interesting a moment ago. You said your novel is suspense. Is there a difference between a mystery novel and a suspense novel?
Well, I think in the mystery writers, we tend to classify the difference as the mystery is more your precinct, your private investigator. You're real more, quote, towards the hard-boiled, the traditional mystery, the Raymond Chandler. Whereas the suspense, and there are a number of us who have formed an organization called Malice Domestic within the framework of the mystery writers, where we write the cozies. Charlotte McLeod is in it, Barbara Michaels, Elizabeth Peters, the kind of mysteries we write, which have to do with people more, and they're not violent, and they have to do with the interrelationships of people. It's called Malice Domestic, is the society, and I think it's a lot of fun.
Cozy? Well, what is a cozy?
Well, the English novel you would call a cozy, you know, set in the village or set in the home, as opposed to an espionage novel, as opposed to a private investigator who's gumshoeing around, you know, and following clues, or something set in the police station. I always write about very nice people whose lives are invaded by evil. You see, in this book, Neve has a fashionable Madison Avenue boutique, which she owns, and her best customer does not show up for the clothes she absolutely had to have on Friday at 3 o'clock. And Neve knows there's something wrong. Everyone else says, Ethel's just a pain in the neck, you know, it's just the sort of thing she'll pull. She'll work us all to death, and then she won't show up. And Neve says, no, there's something wrong. But you see, she's not looking for trouble. She's worried about someone. And all my books are kind of on that level. Nobody's looking for trouble, but trouble happens.
It's interesting that you make your victim a freelance, successful freelance writer who's a real pain in the neck.
Well, I just loved Ethel as a character. I thought, when you're planning, if you have a victim, you can't have her the most lovable person in the world, because you'd have dozens of friends who'd be looking for her. But if you have her rather a nuisance, and if you have her someone who will take off whenever she feels like and break a date if she feels like, then you only have the one lone voice saying, there's trouble, there's something wrong. You see, you have to build the character to the circumstances you want to present.
Yeah, if you make the character, the victim, so sympathetic, it becomes almost a tragedy. Everybody's filled with remorse and guilt. That kind of would cut into the storyline, wouldn't it?
Well, you see, I don't like to ever have a major tragedy in a book. I might have a backstory. For instance, in this one, Neve's mother was murdered 17 years before. But it's a, you know, time has put some distance to that. So her murder has affected her father. It's affected her. And it affects the progress of the book, because the father is so worried that the man whom he believes ordered the execution is now out of jail, and he had threatened Neve as well. So it's very important, but her death is so far removed that I don't feel it becomes an act of tragedy. And I don't like to do that in a book. I don't want to do that. I like my books to have happy endings. You know, I'm Mary Poppins. What can I say?
Well, mysteries are supposed to have happy endings, aren't they?
Well, I think that...
I have everything neatly. The guilty is caught, or are caught.
Yes, the scales of justice are balanced. But I think that the kind of suspense I write should be like buying a ticket on the roller coaster. You know you're going to get scared. You know your heart is going to pound. You know as that thing goes chug, chug, chug up, you're suddenly going to go down in a swoosh and then go around, and you think the car is going to fly off the tracks. And then there's that final terrible drop before you come in. And then suddenly the brake hits and you're home safe, and then you torture your mother for another quarter. At least that's what I did. And I think mystery writing should be like that. Exhilaration, scariness. But then, whew, gee, wasn't that great?
Let's go back. You mentioned you have a little offshoot of the Mystery Writers Group. What was the name of it again?
Malice Domestic.
Now, tell me a little more about that. What does that do exactly?
Well, you see, within the Mystery Writers of America, there are smaller groups who meet just because they're on one particular subject, like the private eyes. There are people who are interested in Sherlock Holmes. There are sisters in crime. There are different groups, and we all are under the same umbrella. But some of us thought it would be a good idea to have one that is more for our kinds of novels of suspense, where you don't see explicit sex and you don't see explicit violence in it. And that's that. We just started it within the last year. We had our first seminar in April in Washington, and it was loads of fun. They gave awards for the best novel, the best short story, the best screenplay, and the awards were teapots with a skull and crossbones on, and they're called the Agathas.
That's interesting. You were at one time president of the...
Oh, yeah, I'm still very active. I'm on the board of directors. I was chairman of the International Crime Writers Congress last year, and I was on the board for the dinner committee that we have, the annual Edgars, as you know, every year. And it's a good group. You know, mystery writers are fun because they're not jealous of each other. They're kind of glad when the other guy does well. There's a great feeling of camaraderie in it that I like a lot.
Well, they must be very proud of you. Didn't I see that you set some sort of contractual record some time ago?
Yeah, when I signed my new contract last year, it was for $10.1 million, which was the highest. I guess it was the first eight-figure contract in publishing history. Now, Jackie Collins has gotten a bigger one since then, but I think I still have the honors, if you will, in the mystery field. So it's sort of fun. It's nice to be successful.
That was three books, though.
It's four books and four it's books. One...
That was only four books.
No, it's four books and it's one collection, and the collection will come out in December. In fact, I got up at 4 this morning to work on the final story in it, which is the lead story, because I've been running around so much doing publicity that I've been away from my computer. But that's called the Anastasia Syndrome, and I'm having great fun with that because I love the idea of regression.
Regression?
Into a former lifetime. I have this gal bringing back a murderess from the past, and she doesn't know she's carrying her in with her. And I think it's a lot of fun.
Now, this is the lead story for a collection, I'm sure.
For the collection that's coming out in December, yeah.
Have these stories been in some of the mystery magazines?
They've been in women's magazines. There are two novellas and two short stories. And oddly, all four of them of the short stories have been sold for films. And then Anastasia is the main story, and that's the one I'm just wrapping up right now.
Imagine there was a lot of celebrating when you got that contract, huh?
Oh, yes. But when I called the kids to tell them, you know, this is the terms of it, one of my sons said, "Now listen, Maz, there are a lot of potholes in New York. You have four books to write. We want you to walk very, very carefully until those books are written." Isn't
Absolutely.
That wonderful?
Absolutely. Well, what happens if you don't produce? You must have deadlines for each book, right?
So. Yeah. They're about every year and a half, and I'm right on target. The first one is out right now.
While My Pretty One Sleeps.
Yeah, and that's the first one that I've hit number one on the Times list in hardcover. So that's a good feeling. It's like planting the flag on Mount Everest, you know, say, once I have been number one. Actually, I'm number one 2 weeks in a row. And then the collection will come out in December. And I hope that I will have finished my new book for next June publication, because I'm working on it now as well.
Well, you've certainly put in your dues, though. This contract was certainly a wonderful thing for you, but you've been working for many years, writing and gradually, steadily building an audience. And that's very important for a writer, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, the thing that always saddens me is when somebody writes a book or a short story or whatever, and gets two rejections, and then gets disheartened, and that's the end of it. And they say, "I guess I'm not a writer." And I say, "No, you're not a writer. Something in you has got to say, I'm going to make it. Keep sending that one out, but be writing the next one. Go to seminars. Go listen. Find out what they want, what the publishers want." You see, the mark of the amateur is somebody who will send a mystery novel to, let's say, a university press that only does doctoral renditions. You've got to study your market a little bit. Find out that this publisher is interested in it, has a new mystery line. These are the things that people ought to do. Or if you're a romance writer, you've got to find out which house is doing what. You have to pay, you know, you have to put a little of effort into it. It's nice to have talent, but you also have to hone that talent, and in a business way as well.
But it must be bewildering to someone who's writing for the first time, and they can pick up a copy of Writer's Digest, and they can leaf through all hundreds of pages and hundreds of publishing houses and magazines. And, of course, there may be only a few that would be applicable to what that person would be writing, but it's baffling, bewildering. So you can understand why they could make a mistake like that, can't you?
Oh, you can make a mistake, but if you go, this is why I always say to writers, would-be writers, go to seminars. I was at one last November, and two young agents spoke. And I just sat in because I've been with the same agent for 27 years, and people say, "How do you get an agent?" You know, and I thought, I want to listen because I get this question so much. And they were terrific because they said things like, "Look, if you write us a letter, we don't want to hear that your husband calls you Muffy and you have five of the greatest kids in the world and a dog and a cat and you have a summer house in Staten Island, you know. We want to hear enclosed is a book so-and-so. It contains, the setting is a garden in which several murders occur. And then the reason why the garden, maybe. I have a degree in botany. I have a knowledge of." You see what I mean? So you get the feeling of this person is knows what he's talking about, or she's talking about. Because they've said, if you can't write a letter that sells us, how can you write a book? And that's the sort of thing you learn when you go to seminars. And I had said that time that I would read three manuscripts over the weekend. Well, the first one really needed so much work that it needed to be rewritten. The second had great possibilities, and I told the gal what I thought she ought to do with it. The third one was wonderful, wonderful. And it was co-written, and I said to the two gals, look, you go to this agent. She lives near you, as it turned out. They're from California, and she was from California. You tell her she should read this book and take you on. You tell her she will sell it, and you tell her that I will do an endorsement for it. P.S., it all happened. And they have just sold it to the films. Okay?
Well, of course, I've been in the periphery of publishing for a long time, doing reviews and this sort of thing, but I remember some time ago, I was talking to a young woman from Cincinnati who had a friend, and they were writing a mystery novel together. And they had written one chapter of it, and she knew I had done the series on books. And she said, our idea is to send this sample chapter and the plot to a publishing house. And I said, well, you know, my understanding is this, that you're talking about a novel here, and maybe it would be better to write the whole novel and then send it off, because you have no track record, there's no reason for, even if the first chapter is good, there's no indication, because of your lack of a track record, that you'll finish it in the appropriate way. And I don't think they ever finished it, and they probably never would, unless they had some sort of offer out front, but doesn't it make sense to write the whole thing?
Absolutely. When you're doing a first novel and you don't have a track record, I think it makes infinitely more sense to have finished a book and then send it in. And then if the editor finds that she has something to work with, she knows what she's talking about. But you see, an experienced writer, and they know that that person has done 5 or 10 books, can send a chapter in and say, this is what I'm doing with it. And the editor will know, okay, we know she knows what she's doing.
And, of course, in your case, contracting for 5 unwritten books.
Yeah.
but then you have a track record, so they know what you can do. And what
they know, and they know that I turn books in on time and that I work hard until I get them right. So,
do you have any tips that you can offer a struggling writer? You said you worked with a computer. It must make life a lot easier than the typewriter.
Oh, I love it, yeah. I love a computer. Well, what I always tell people is don't wait for the ideal moment until you can quit the job, until the kids are grown up, until you retire, until you have a room that can be quiet. I used to write on the kitchen table with all the kids running around and the dog barking because there was no other room in the house to do it. If you really want to write, you will find the time every day. I got up very, very early in the morning, so I could get it in before the day started and I had to go to a job. If you're a night person, when everyone goes to bed, write at night for an hour. If you wrote 1 page a day, at the end of a year, you'd have a book. And
well,
that's what makes
says,
the difference.
How do you discipline yourself to write 1 page? I mean, I try to write, and I can sit there for 3 hours and nothing comes out.
Eventually it does, though. It's like priming the pump and priming it. If you sit at that computer, hopefully a computer word processor, something will start to happen. I mean, when I start a new book, I groan because I know what I'm getting myself into. If I've gone away to do publicity or whatever, then it takes 3 days to warm up again because I'm away from it. I have to read the whole book up to where I am now. It's as though you let the souffle fall. But everybody has to do that. There are very few of us who can live in such a precious environment that you say, I won't do this and I won't do that and don't bother me. I had a friend who used to put a sign out, writer at work. I thought it was so pretentious. And she would work 1 year, her husband would work another year. Nothing would interfere with their writing. P.S. In the beginning, she had sold a couple of short stories, and we all thought that she was going to be the star of our workshop. And she hasn't sold anything in 20 years. Because being in the mainstream is one of the best ways of knowing what's going on. And when you take yourself out of the mainstream, unless you are one of those writers who simply must be off in the mountaintop, I think you're better off if you have an ear for what's going on in the world.
Yeah, I was talking to a young man named Ian Fraser who wrote a wonderful book called Great Plains. He went off to Montana to write a novel out in the wilderness. And, of course, he never wrote the novel. Novel never materialized.
Yeah.
But he did wind up writing a nonfiction book about the Great Plains.
Well, fine. He got something out of the deal. But, no, the bucolic life is not for me at all. I like a little action. I mean, I like my home is in New Jersey, and it's peaceful there, as peaceful as it can be with two phones ringing all the time and all the rest of it. But the idea of being off in the great lonely wilderness, I would find so intensely boring.
And distracting.
Distracting to the point where you don't want to write.
Yeah, I always wondered about these writers who would go off to the Mediterranean to write. And so it seems to me you're in a new territory that you have to explore and new languages. And it would just seem to me to write effectively, you go to familiar surroundings where you're not distracted, unless there's a refrigerator.
Yeah, exactly. Like that. That's the only thing is the refrigerator. Yeah. Well, I've gone up to the McDowell Colony when I was first starting to do books. And that was terrific. You were in your own cabin during the day, but you had breakfast with a bunch of other writers and artists and musicians in the morning and wrote all day by yourself in your cabin, but then at night had dinner with everybody. So that was great because everybody was going off to his or her own place. And they slipped lunch, they didn't slip it under the door, they put it on the porch. So you knew when you got there at 8 o'clock in the morning, there you were until 6 o'clock at night. And I got a lot of work done there, but I don't need that anymore because the kids are all grown and I live alone, so why go to a cabin when I got a library?
That was pre-computer anyway, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah, I brought my own typewriter up in the backyard, and I can in the back of the trunk, rather. In the trunk, not the back of the trunk. But now, when you have a computer screen, it's so liquid. The words move. You do a clumsy sentence and you can beep it right out. Then I do fine editing on the hard copy and then go back into the machine and fix it up.
Oh, it's really neat. You make a little mistake. Maybe you want to add a sentence in the middle of a page. You don't have to retype the whole page.
Oh, God, the retyping used to aggravate me so, and the ballooning and the Xing in and the Xing out and the whole business. And then I'd have to retype because no human being could read it, including myself.
And it's probably discouraging to writers to do this, you know, so they might have a sentence that's perhaps a little clumsy and they'll just let it stay there. But the computer, you don't have to let it stay there.
No, you can take it out. You can just beep it right out. And it's wonderful.
So you really cut your time, don't you?
And you see, by not having the pages pile up, of course, the newer typewriters, the thing moves, the platen moves automatically. But in the old one, remember how the bell would ring and you'd forget and you'd pile up and you'd have seven letters and then you had to untangle them. And that's so darn distracting. The computer moves itself around.
I once used a typewriter that the carriage bar didn't work, so if it got to the end of the sentence, I had to roll it.
And you had to roll. Oh, that's lovely.
I got used to it, though. Well, Mary Higgins Clark, it's always a delight talking to you, and you're very relaxed. You're very good at this. I think you may secretly enjoy doing tours because you have a nice way with people. And I know you like to talk about your work.